entitled Political Economy of Water and Agriculture. And the chair of this panel, I'm delighted to say, is Olcay Unver, who is director of the Global Water Assessment Unit at UNESCO. He is tremendously well qualified and experienced in both international and national academic spheres. I won't go in in depth to his background, but you have it available to you in the materials that were distributed. We're absolutely delighted to have Olcay with us, guiding us as chair of this panel. So with that, I'll turn it over to you, Olcay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Eric. Good morning. The first panel of the program today is on the political economy of water and agriculture. Exactly 2 weeks ago, during the first day of the Fifth World Water Forum in Istanbul, we launched the third edition of the World Water Development Report, and obviously agriculture was one of the big components of the report. In the preparatory work, we spent quite a bit of time how to deal with aspects such as agriculture, energy, food security, whether or not we should describe them as drivers or users. Regardless, we ended up using them, describing them as users, but we realized that the externalities that were affecting water were more or less the same for agriculture, including population growth, demographics, changes in dietary preferences, the changes in lifestyles, and increasing demand for non-agricultural products such as bioenergy. We also indicated in the report that these drivers, externalities, should not be considered in isolation of related socioeconomic and or political factors and other externalities, and they were all linked to one another. Looking at the program, I am glad to report to you that we were on the same wavelength, and the political economy of water and agriculture panel will look at and explore the linkages between water and agriculture and look at key variables such as energy, climate change, sustainability, and discrepancies between rural and urban water access. The panel has three extraordinary speakers. I will introduce them at the beginning and then invite them to come to the podium one at a time. The first speaker is Mark Rosegrand with the International Food Policy Research Institute, and he will talk about energy demand and climate change effects on water and food. The second speaker is Mr. Zhu Rongmei with the Chinese Academy of Agricultural Sciences. Dr. Mei will talk about sustainability issues related to water and agriculture in China, and he will elaborate on environmental impacts and smallholder farmers. The third presenter is Jason Clay with the World Wildlife Fund. Jason will talk about environmental impacts of commodities production. The first two speakers will make PowerPoint presentations, so I will be listening from the audience. After Dr. May makes his presentation, I invite all of the three panelists to the table so Jason can make his presentation from the table and we can continue with the discussion and question and answer. With this, welcome back again, and I invite Mark to make his presentation.
Grant, right there. Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to, in about 15 minutes, try to cover a very big set of topics, so it'll be pretty much an overview, but I hope I can bring some food for thought to this discussion. What I'm going to do in my talk is just briefly look at what these most recent trends in global food and energy prices have been. Then I'll talk about what the contributing factors are to food security and food scarcity and price rises. Just touching a bit on what happened the last 7 or 8 years, but really looking going from there to a forward-looking assessment. Then I'll do a sort of a broad overview of some policy recommendations for how can we get pro-poor growth in agriculture that is not damaging to the environment and water in particular. I think all of you are familiar now with this with graphs that look like this in terms of trends from 2000 to early this year on energy prices and key commodities, including wheat, rice, and maize. As you can all see, we saw some steady increases in commodity prices up through about May 2006 and into 2007, and then you saw huge spikes running up into 2008, early 2008. Then you've seen quite a dramatic fall since about May 2008. But one thing I'd like to point out is that aside from the oil price, which is in the red, the other commodity prices have indeed not fallen to the extent as oil. They've been stronger, and their futures prices now indicate we're expecting stronger prices over the coming year for a number of factors, and I'll go into those a bit now. I think we all know at least parts of the story about this past several years. One of the factors involved certainly was biofuels, and particularly the corn ethanol policies in the United States and biodiesel policies also in Europe. The sugarcane policies, as John Briscoe's all already pointed out, had very little to do with food price increases. You can get estimates all over the place for what contribution of biofuels was to that. Our estimates at IFPRI say it's about 30% of the increase in cereal or grain prices was due to biofuels, with a heavier percentage on maize or corn, as would be expected. But I think even more important than the biofuels have been the changing fundamentals that underlie agricultural growth and food security. I think everyone is familiar with the rapid income growth in much of Asia, particularly in India and China. But what hasn't been noticed quite as much is that Africa has had a relative boom also since the late 1990s, with overall growth in sub-Saharan Africa of over 5% in annual GDP. And these countries, in particular in Africa, have a high propensity to consume food out of increased income, and were a significant boost to the growth in demand for food staples such as rice, corn, and wheat. Very important and perhaps most fundamental was the underinvestment in agricultural productivity and technology growth. And again, John has already talked about that and shown the significant declines in investment in agriculture over a 20 to 30-year period, which has caused significant slowdowns in productivity growth in terms of output per unit of land or water. Water and land scarcity, and particularly in this past several years, water scarcity in terms of production shocks due to droughts in Australia, the Ukraine, and others also played an important part. And what I'm going to say these factors are going to be much more important in the future, and I'm going to talk about that in a moment in the context of climate change. Energy prices also drove high input and transport costs, which further hit the ag sector. And then in that huge run-up where you did get a bubble effect in early 2008, there were a number of impacts from bad trade policies where countries put export bans like Vietnam on rice and erected high tariff barriers to protect their own consumers while exporting high prices to other countries. That also helped trigger even lower stocks and greater speculation. And also exchange rate movements had something to do with it as well. But what happens then in the longer run? If we look in the long term, a world with higher energy prices than we have historically have. As you see, prices are already back up again to, what, $50 per barrel currently after the slide down in 2008. A number of things are going to happen. One is I think we are going to have increased demand for biofuels again. That's not just a temporary phenomenon. We will have new technologies out there eventually, but right now there's nothing on the immediate horizon to replace the current generation of ethanol. The cellulosics and so forth may come in 5 years, but that's also what they were saying 5 years ago. Higher energy costs, I think very importantly, are going to increase the cost of water pumping and conveyance and also of desalinization. That, together with the higher value of water because of both higher food prices and these higher costs of generating water, are going to put much more pressure on needing efficient allocation and likely including water markets or other kinds of economic allocation methods, and on conservation so that technologies and investments in new technologies for water management are going to be necessary. Overall, higher energy prices are going to make water and power subsidies too costly. And if there's a silver lining over the long-term change in relative underlying factor prices in agriculture, it is that bad policies are just going to become too costly to do. I think if India attempts to continue the same water and power subsidies that they have for agriculture now, I think they really are going to break their national and state budgets. It just costs too much at the higher prices. High energy prices also have effects on land, and this goes on both crops and livestock. In the livestock area, you're going to get higher feed prices as food prices go up, and as the energy cost of intensive livestock production goes up. So you're going to expect livestock prices to go up with some impacts on consumption, but also with pressure to move towards extensive conversion of additional pasture land to production of livestock, perhaps to substitute for loss of production in the more intensive systems that become more expensive. So again, because of energy prices and higher food prices, there's going to be a much greater pressure on the land base. In addition, you've seen already in the United States and in other parts of the world that increased demand for land will lead to less conservation and expansion of the agricultural land base unless we have countervailing improvements in agricultural productivity growth. We've already seen the conservation program land being transferred into energy crops here in the U.S. was shifting to maize for biofuels. And I think some people are thinking, well, maybe this is a short-term phenomenon and we'll work our way out. I do want to point out that there's likely to be very large demands for significant expansion of biofuels or land-based biomass for climate mitigation in the future. And this is just one sample. This happens to be from MIT's group that works on long-term climate change and integrative assessment issues. On the upper left-hand corner there, you see a reference scenario for the expansion of land area where there's no attempt to control greenhouse gas emissions. So it was sort of a very radical business as usual scenario. You can see in there that biomass, that sort of light green in the middle, doesn't come in to heavy production until about 2040 into any production until 2040 to 2050. But in what we hope is going to be a much more realistic scenario in the lower right-hand corner, where you put in policies in terms of carbon taxes and cap and trade policies to try to get a cumulative reduction of emissions by 40% from 2012 to 2100, which isn't that aggressive, to be honest. I mean, that's sort of a mid-level mitigation path. You can see that biomass now comes in much earlier and much bigger, and it particularly takes away forests from both pasture land, natural grass areas, which often have high biodiversity, and forest area. So the issue of biofuels and biomass is here to stay for the future. And this is just one example. If you look at any of the other major integrated assessment models, they have similar roles for biomass in the future. What's going to happen under climate change, which I think is probably going to be the game changer in the agriculture area? This is work done by Arnell, looking at changes in global annual runoff from now to about the mid-2050s. Here you see the reds and pink numbers are more red numbers are the highly negative ones, anywhere from 20 to 30% and greater reductions in runoff. You see that much of Africa, much of the productive areas in the United States, and in significant areas in Brazil, for example, are going to have very bad drop-offs and runoff. The other one to point out here is that India looks, hey, that looks pretty good. They're going to get 20 to 30% more runoff in general. But even that is misleading because the models now are showing that that additional runoff is going to be highly concentrated in short periods of time when it is not easily storable or catchable for agriculture. So much of that instead will be increasing floods in the wrong time of the year for crops. What happens in general with declining water in key areas and also a very rapid increase in industrial domestic use of water? This is from our own model, impact model, which is an integrated agriculture and water supply and demand model that does long-term projections. What we see is with fairly rapid growth in industrial and domestic, about nearly doubling between now and 2050, that irrigation, in fact, water is basically going to be about at the same levels now at best by 2050. So there's no more water that's going to be diverted under business usual scenario for irrigation. So you need to have very dramatic increases in water use efficiency and agriculture productivity to get the kinds of gains in production that you're going to need over time. This is a sort of simple way to summarize the effect of water scarcity. And again, this is under a climate change scenario. Water scarcity to grain production, and you can do similar exercises for other major commodities. Here we estimate an aggregate number for the world or for the developing countries of loss of grain production due to water scarcity. This is simply doing the long-term projections to compute the difference between what full water adequacy would be compared to the actual projected water adequacy over time. You can see currently in the 1990s we had a loss of about 100 million tons of grain per year. But we're projecting under this scenario over 450 million tons of losses annually, and this is rice, wheat, maize, and other grains, every year in 2050. And that's equivalent to the current annual production of the United States and Canada. So basically, due to water scarcity, you're losing the entire production of the North American breadbasket every year by 2050. These are some new results we're doing at IFPRI, we're trying to look at a much more disaggregated look by crop and by subnational spatial units of the impact of climate change on maize yields. This is using the Hadley GCM and the so-called A2A scenario, which is about 2 years ago, this was considered a quite aggressive high temperature scenario. Now it's considered to be probably about a medium scenario given the most recent science. And this shows for a maize variety that's reasonably well adapted to drought. It's not a super drought tolerant variety, but it shows, I think, the very dramatic challenge that's going to be facing us. And we have similar results that are just as dramatic for rice and wheat. The yellows and the reds there are losses anywhere from 5 to 25% of current levels of yields. And I draw your attention also to the brown color, which you can see particularly in the United States in parts of the southern Corn Belt and in much of Europe, but also through just the sub-Saharan countries in Africa and elsewhere. Those are areas where you will actually lose the ability to produce corn altogether because of changes in growing seasons. There is some compensation also, but with new area in the north that's shown by green, but those areas have much lower productivity and probably less sustainability. So overall, we're projecting worldwide yields would decline by 17% due to climate change, and this includes temperature and water effects. What does that mean for food scarcity and food prices? Well, quick measure of that is our prices. And this is the global price of maize under the baseline, which has climate change. So that's the blue line, and the red line shows what would happen without climate change. And this is so the difference between those is the impact of climate change on global prices of maize as it works its way through the agriculture economy. As you can see, if you have the same weather as you had the past 30 years, the red line, you would get these increases in prices currently, but then they would start to tail off. With climate change, though, we get steady, long-term increases in the real price of agricultural commodities, and we find that for the other commodities as well. So just briefly then, summarize, I think those are some of the key points are what the impacts are going to be of high energy prices and climate change. So what do we do to try to, in a sense, make it so those scenarios don't come true? I mean, the first step, and this is, I think, very consistent with what John was saying also, is really the need for massive increases in investment for increasing crop productivity per unit of land and per unit of water. That includes both straight agriculture research, crop breeding, water management, but also investment in rural infrastructure. In crop breeding, you're going to have to target much more aggressively the abiotic and biotic stresses. That includes drought tolerance, salinity tolerance, nitrogen use efficiency, and pest resistance as well, that are going to be particularly getting worse under climate change. And there is going to have to be much more use of GMOs and biotechnology. There's simply not enough natural variation genetically to deal with the new environments that we're going to be seeing. So, I do agree that it's distasteful for some, but I see no other solution than significant increases in the use of GMOs. The water area, I think one thing that does come on the table now is larger investments in larger dams for storage to reduce the variability, to increase storage where water is available is declining. But those investments need to be also complemented by more on-farm oriented management, including water harvesting, minimum tillage practices, integrated soil fertility management. Then on top of the investment in water infrastructure, we also need large investments additionally in roads, particularly in Africa, but also in parts of Asia and Latin America, to improve farmer access to markets, to risk insurance, and to credit and other inputs. I think one of the problems that still is bedeviling the whole issue of how do you get rapid growth under this new system of high energy prices and climate change is that policies are made in very uncoordinated fashion. And to go beyond that, we need to move to a full integration of policies that are aimed at agriculture growth, biofuels and energy, climate change, and carbon sequestration. So both as an institutional component, that the government agencies involved in these have to start talking to each other, so it's not the Ministry of Finance doing one thing, Ministry of Environment, Agriculture doing other things. But there's also a fundamental policy issue that in order to deal with these competing demands for land and water and the trade-offs with environment, we can only meet these if we start to bring seriously the externalities of the use of different inputs in different production systems into the growth equation. To do that, we need to establish economic incentives for water use based on water rights or water entitlements. So I was pleased to see Pakistan is actually moving seriously in that direction. But beyond water, we also need to look at markets for environmental services. There's various things have worked around the world, but there's a long way to go in terms of payment for environmental services for watershed management and biodiversity. We also, though, need to develop markets for agricultural and forest carbon to generate new value streams in rural areas through carbon mitigation. And many of the investments that would reduce carbon emissions are also exactly what's needed to improve productivity of land, such things as minimum tillage and other types of efficient water and land management at the local level. Thanks very much.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's my pleasure to be here and to show some information from China and water and agriculture. As an organizer, they asked me to talk about the sustainability issues related to water and agriculture in China. I want to first get a very quick review of agriculture in China and focus on water scarcity and food security in China. And I will discuss other sustainability issues and mention how we can achieve the sustainability in China. If we look at the data that Chinese agriculture, that we use 8% of the arable land of the world and 6% of renewable water. That means the rainfall and the discharge annually. But we consume 32% of a chemical fertilizer. We produce, I'm sorry, that's a mistake, it's 19% of the cereal, of the world cereal, and the 30% of the meat, 38% fruits and vegetables, and we serve 20% of the population. If we look forward that the next, till 2030, the Chinese agriculture, the major task could be ensure the food security, and we also need the Chinese agriculture would have some action in protect and restore the health of the agro ecosystem. And also, we need to poverty reduction in rural regions and promote urbanization and agricultural modernizations. I will give you some detailed explanation on food security. We are planted that for cereal demand by 2030, we need 0.62 billion metric tons of cereal production, and now we have about for last year is 0.52 billion metric tons of cereal was produced. That means 0.1 billion metric tons of cereal we need that to produce by 2030. This could be ensure our guarantees that for cereal self-sufficiency could be 95%. I'm a quick poverty reduction and urbanizations and focus on the water scarcity and the food security. We look at the water requirement in Chinese agriculture. Currently, the cereal production consumes 570 billion cubic meters of water, and of which 170 billion cubic meters come from irrigation. Another 400 billion cubic meters of water come from rainfall utilization. Our irrigation water use ratio is about 45%. The rainwater use ratio about 55%. So if we look at the water use efficiency in cereal production over in China, there could be 1 metric ton of cereal. We need 1,100 cubic meters of water. We have some prediction that if we use the data that I just showed that by 2030, 4.62 billion tons of cereal production, we need at least 680 billion cubic meters of water. This is what the Chinese agriculture, the requirement of Chinese agriculture, if we want to achieve our target by 2030. But now that the water supply, the gross water, we have some shortage because till now 400 billion cubic meters of water are located and limited for agriculture. By 2030, this is a maximum. In these numbers of water, only 350 billion cubic meters of water for irrigation. If you look at the picture, 117 billion cubic meters of water that come from irrigation agriculture. Our irrigation water use ratio is something about very close to the 50%. In other aspects, the malfunction of land resources distribution over the China, they make some difficulties to Chinese agriculture. Because if you look at the northern China, we have 56% of arable land, but we only have 19% of water resources. We make some calculation, and we use the water consumptions here currently and by 2030, and we find that 110 billion cubic meters of water was short for the further agriculture. The another pictures that we make some statistical that if we make a study with since the establishment of New China to 1980s and then 1980 to 2000, and we see that the irrigation, the effective irrigation acreage that promote the gross cereal production before 1980s. But after 1980s, the promoter of the gross cereal production is changes to some fertilizer and varieties improvement. And we show this picture, and you get very clear idea. By 2000, the effective irrigation acreage that peaked to the maximum. And in recent years, we do not see significant changes or increments of effective irrigation acreage. But our gross cereal production, they have some increased. Here, there's some phenomena about the by 2003 and 2004, there's a drop of gross cereal production. The reason is either is one reason is about the disaster, the other is about some policy, and we change some cereal production to some cash crop. Besides this gross water shortage and water pollution, as well as global change that reduce the water availability in agriculture. And we see that we do not have the data recently, but if we look at the data here, drought hazardous acreage of crops since 1950s to 1990s, it's increased significantly, and by now, about 10% of the cereal production was lost by the disaster. Its measure is about the drought. If rather than water scarcity, we have some other sustainability issues. The number one is the climate change. If we look at we observed temperature since 1950s to 2004. And we understood that in the northern part of China, it could be already changed to dry and hot. As you know, the major Chinese agriculture, especially for cereal production, is concentrated on northeastern part, in the central China, and in the downstream of the Yangtze River. So you see the right part of China that we change already get the temperature high. If you look at the climate change, SRES A2 scenario, I think that is just we should A1 scenarios. All the prediction of the result show that in northern part of China will be changed to warmer and dry, but south part of China will be changed to cool and wet. So our teams in the institute, we do some research on the climate change on yield and the arable land. By the 2030, gross cereal productivity in China can reduce 5 to 10% if no action is taken. We do also some simulation that in the second half of the 21st century, climate change can cause yield reduction in rice, maize, and wheat up to 37%. That means that if with no actions to taking for climate change, there could be a dramatic impact of climate change on cereal production. And we see the simulated result of rice yield in 2080, and the down maps that show some arable land, all the arable land will be reduced 13% as well. The other sustainability issues that we still have some from economic or trade patterns, and we show some domestic produce and the trade patterns, and if you look at the data of the Chinese agriculture, about the half irrigated farmland is pasteurized. All this pasteurized is mainly distributed on the southern part of China. As you know, if we develop water-saving agriculture, pasteurized could be significant that to water conserved. But when we conserve the from pasteurized, the difficult we have some still have some problem how to deliver this saved water to the north, because north is the very severe shortage regions. But another thought is that by now, north deliver also cereal to the south. Annually, we make estimation at about 15 billion cubic meters of water was delivered from north to the south due to the cereal transportations. That means that it's all one-third of the Yellow River discharge annually. So you will see north with lack of water, but we still deliver some cereal production from the south. The other aspect about economic water transfers, within the agriculture in recent years, fruits, vegetables, and the livestock compete land and water use with the cereal. So if we remember the maps that by the 2004-2003, there is a drops of the gross cereal production. This means that some fruits, vegetables, and livestock developed rapidly in that period of time. Also, competitive water utilization induced limited water transfer from agriculture to industry and urbanizations. And we also have that from the transformation, transfer from agriculture to non-agriculture purpose, agriculture is also paid as a compensation for the infrastructure constructions, particularly for irrigation improvement. But this compensation is also under volume. It cannot, it's not enough. The other issues are the commodity and the water pricing. As you know that during the food crisis in China, cereal price maintained relatively low and stable because the central government controlled the cereal production at a low level. It helps inflation, but the side effect for farmers' income. As you know, that the energy, the power, is more costly, but in the cereal price is maintained relatively low. And there was also water price. Many scientists they speak out that they could raise the water price. As well as fertilizer, pesticides, or gasoline machinery. But all these prices are controlled and maintained a low level. In such situation, central government want to maintain the cereal production as constantly levels that can serve the state target. But the other impact of this policy that yield some non-point source pollution, because if the fertilizer, the price is low, the farmer can use more and more fertilizer if there is a benefit from fertilizer input. So also, we have some contradiction between national target and the farmers' livelihoods. For ensure food security, water and ecological safety is a national target, but the farmer, they pay more attention on the livelihoods like food and income. So land and water competed under limitation acts as a cereal with cash crop, with irrigation and fertilization, and also non-point source pollution control. All this mixed together this shows some difficulties when there's a limit of land and water resources. The other issues is we should see that in China, all the agriculture is smallholder farmers, and some one families that there could be maybe half hectares in north, in south, less than half. The small farmer, there is some difficulties for technical extensions that small and individual farmer first is very difficult to uniform the productions. The farmers can choose maize, can choose wheat, even they choose the same weights but the different varieties and the difficult to control the product quality. So the technical transfer is difficult under different skill and education background. Different family has different education background, and also they have different farmland. And also it's very difficult to give them the latest information. So are these sustainability issues, and how we can achieve sustainability for Chinese agriculture? If we look back all the issues together to the on the small scale farmers, that the other the impact that do not have enough and the clean water in time for agriculture. Currently, due to the water shortage, some farmers they use the untreated wastewater directly for irrigation. Sometimes. This yield another problem of food quality. They also suffer from a severe drought, and they also, under the price system, they reduce the willingness for cereal production, and also they yield some non-point source pollution for agriculture. So, at the beginning, I just say that for Chinese agriculture, strategically, we should focus on food security, ecological health, poverty reduction, urbanizations, and each kind of tasks, we have some questions, and also we give some strategies. And by now, Chinese government learned from this research result and adopt some strategies like resources, land and water shortage. We use technical substitution strategies, and we also use agro-industry expansion strategies that to improve farmers' income. And in the middle, technical innovation and the capability improvement strategies are become some project in the central government project that to increase the agriculture capability. As we see that there is more than 100 billion cubic meters of water shortage, and we make some water balance calculation, And if we can use to improve water use ratio, that means we need to invest in some infrastructure. And also improve the water use efficiency. That means we should improve technologies and applications, that we can also, we can achieve the water balance and from calculation and the predictions. So I think there's a such kind of water shortage that could be saluted by some capital invest and the technical investment. So there are four aspects of how to achieve towards the sustainability. The first thing, improve investment for infrastructure. As you know, if you see some newspaper that we just undergoing to the new socialism countryside building project, and we use some investment to improve irrigation system and the water harvesting. Also, the capital invest also works on soil fertility enhancement and the machinery, technical service facilities. The second point is to strengthen technical extension and application. And I don't show some exact numbers of research and develop the capital investment, but every recent years, the investment of R&D and the increase that by now is about 1.1% of the GDP. Okay. So the second is outside the training, the government launched a technical skills to farmer project, and also we do some education knowledge popularization. The third point is to perfect the strategies and policies. We hope that it can reduce tax and fees from agriculture production, it's already done, and increase subsidies, already done, and also improve pricing system. By now, I just mentioned just the exam and the preparations, and also we need some compensation from resource received and environment sound practices, just in discussion. So in the last, we promote socio-economic support, and we emphasize on urban promote rural economy and the commercial insurance to reduce farmers' risk, as well as tax regulation to combat waste. So this is what I want to show. Thank you.
Sorry about that.
The optimal change, maximum change possible.
Thank you. So I was working with famine victims from Ethiopia, living in Sudan as refugees, and talked to a person at one point who told me an expression that the Oromo in Ethiopia use, which goes something like this: you can't wake a person who's pretending to sleep. I think we've finally pretended to wake up to climate change and have begun to address that issue. We're beginning to wake up to the issue of water, and before it's all said and done, we'll probably begin to wake up to other issues that are currently defined as externalities in our economic system. But at some point, the equation of population time consumption has got to bear a direct relationship to the resources on the planet. Right now, it's over the level of the carrying capacity of the planet. World Wildlife Fund produces a report each year called the Living Planet Index, and it shows that at this point in time, we're at about 1.3 planets worth of consumption. For farmers, that means we're eating our seed. For people who still have investments in banks, that means you're eating your principal.
This is not a tenable situation in the long term. And this is to date. By 2050, there are going to be 3 billion more people, 50% more than today. 70% are going to live in cities. They're going to have income that is 2.8 times as great as it is today. Their consumption is going to double, and food consumption may actually increase even more than that because it tends to lead consumption as groups get more income and become more affluent. And then there's climate change and how it's going to affect all of this. It's important, I think, to also look at things like agriculture and ranching from the point of land use. Today, they currently occupy 33% of the planet. But if you take out the deserts and mountains and rivers and lakes and streams and the uninhabitable areas, they occupy 55% of what's left. And it's growing at 0.6 of 1% a year. We are literally eating up the landscape. This has implications for water because habitat is one of the sponges. It is one of the slow releases of water into our ecosystem. And we've got to figure out in the end how to do more with less, or there's going to be no natural habitat left on the planet. If we can continue to move agriculture through the environment at 0.6 of 1% per year for up to 2050, there will be no natural habitat left. The only habitat that will be left is in protected areas, which represent about 12% of the planet. Water scarcity, similarly, is common and is increasing at alarming rates. I think the two are actually connected. More than a dozen major rivers globally are dry at least part of the year, and this is mostly due to taking water out, mostly for agriculture, but also for other uses. Climate change is going to make water availability even more variable, and companies are already beginning to invest in and plan their infrastructure investments based on predictions of water availability in the future. In 1900, ag used 90% of all the water used by humans on the planet. Today it uses a little less than 70%. But the problem with that trend is that ag uses 5 times more water than it did in 1900. Rice alone uses 14% of all the water used by people on the planet. So where's the water? Where does all this water go? How much water is there in a Coke? It takes Coke about 2.5 liters of water to make every liter of Coke. But it takes between 175 and 250 liters of water to grow the sugar that's in every liter of Coke. How much water is in a grande latte? Anybody care to guess? About 208 liters embedded in a grande latte. That includes the plastic lid, the paper cup and wrapper, the sugar, the milk, the coffee. Doesn't include any of the transport. The coffee is about 145. The milk is about 45 to 46, et cetera, et cetera. Who's responsible for embedded water? Food companies control less than 15% of the embedded impacts that it takes to produce the products that they sell. Walmart estimates that they control about 8% directly of the impacts of the foods that they sell in their store. That means that at least 85% lies outside of the control of companies. But who's responsible? Is it credible for companies to sell products where they know and have to know where those products come from a health and safety point of view, but are not responsible for how they're produced? I doubt it. I think the issue of defining responsibility is going to be the issue of this century. Let me put this another way and a little more directly. Should consumers really have choices? Should they have the choice to buy products that are produced inefficiently, unsustainably? Should there only be good choices on the shelf? Should companies have the choice to buy raw materials that are not produced sustainably? How do we make that vision a reality? We live in a system of global trade, very efficient for at least what is monitored. but we have no global governance, particularly over natural resources. And that's the rub. And we're not likely to have global governance for some time. So the role of private sector and voluntary standards is going to be increasingly important. Governments simply are not up to the job. How do we reduce water use in agriculture? Well, clearly we can be more efficient. We can get a lot more with a lot less. We can move from flood to furrow, from furrow to every other furrow, from every other furrow to center pivot, from center pivot to modified drip center pivot, from modified drip center pivot to drip irrigation, and from drip irrigation to buried drip irrigation. We can increase soil carbon and organic matter through no-till, conservation tillage, by eliminating burning of agricultural residues can increase stream flow, can reduce water, pesticide, and fertilizer use, and can be a source of renewable energy, as Brazilian sugarcane production is proving right now. But I think paying for carbon may be one of the most important ways and the best ways to increase water availability and to increase use efficiency in agriculture. But another way is to begin to simply measure. How much water do we use to produce anything? If we don't start measuring, we're never going to start managing. I challenged Brazilian poultry producers recently to have the amount of water that it takes them to produce a bird and process it. Today it's about 32 liters per kilo. Their goal, and they're most of the way there already, is 16. That's cutting it in half. That's a good start. We also know that if you provide water to cacao in the dry season, you'll double production. People are already beginning to capture rainfall and catchments areas and then use plastic piping to drip it onto trees during the dry season. This can be done, and it's cost-effective. And then there are water-resistant genes that can be found and brought into cultivation to increase production by 25 to 100%. We need to explore all of these avenues and not invest in any single one as a silver bullet. But we've also got to get the price for water right. The grower of sugar that goes into a Coke, the 175 to 255 liters of water that's used, actually receives about half of a cent for the cane that they grow. The farmer that produces the milk that goes into a Kraft single actually gets about 3 cents for the 40 liters of water that they use. The rancher that produces the meat for a double quarter pounder with up to 15,000 liters of embedded water gets paid 25 cents for that meat. Now, the question is 25 cents, and this is the gross amount, it's not the net, is 25 cents a good payment for 15,000 liters of water? We simply don't have the prices right. The basic price of commodity is too low for anybody to pay for water, and it's certainly too low for struggling farmers. There's no free lunch when it comes to water. Using water, whether it's green or blue, is always going to have impacts. The real question, I think, before this group and before people on this planet going forward is which impacts are acceptable at what levels. We're going to consume these products, but can we take it from 208 liters to 175 to 160, get it down to 140, maybe 125, survival by 1,000 cuts? That's what we need to begin to do. But I think linking values in a way that they haven't been linked before as well, so that corn and soy and palm oil and cotton and coffee and cocoa include the price of carbon. And that's definitely on the horizon. Something that's maybe just a little over the horizon is including the price or the cost of water as well in those products. If we're going to have a sustainable planet by 2050, then we're going to have to do some things. And this is, these are some of the things that we have been thinking about and working with companies, ag companies, producers, brands, retailers, seed companies, et cetera, banks. A vision for sustainable supply chains by 2050 would include zero loss of natural habitat. We simply cannot continue to eat away at the environment and have sustainable ecosystems. 50% reduction in water use per unit of output. And that will just break us even if we have 50% more consumption. So we're going to have to be very efficient about this. Zero loss of soil carbon. That means no erosion. We know that without erosion, we actually have better use of water, better use of pesticides, better use of fertilizers, reduced use by as much as 50%, some studies in Brazil have shown. So we can do more with less, and we're going to have to. The real question is that going to be enough? And the real question in the U.S., which consumes far higher levels of natural resources per capita than any other country on the planet, is the question of can we live with less with less? That's the challenge for this country. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jason. This concludes the presentations. We, based on the groundwork that John established in his keynote speech, we have heard from three speakers about different aspects. I guess there were commonalities in all presentations, including the fact that decisions regarding water are not made by water managers, but by leaders in other sectors and other decision makers. We don't know enough about water, how much water we have, what its quality is, how much water we use, and how we manage it. And the more we need, we realize that the less information we have. There are pricing systems that can be utilized, but the existing systems are not necessarily conducive for saving water. But there are tools such as water footprints, virtual water, scenario tools that we can make use of. The challenge is how we proceed with all these. We have about 10 to 12 minutes for questions and answers and contributions from the audience. So the floor is yours. Please stand up when you ask a question and state your name and affiliation if you can. And please indicate the person, the presenter to whom you are directing your question. We can also have email questions if we have some.
Not yet.
Okay. Yes. Can we have the microphone there?
Oh, thanks. Yeah, my name is Charles Eisland with the World Resources Institute. Several people, including Dr. Briscoe, have mentioned the need for establishing water allocations as they've done in Australia, and for water prices that reflect the true value of water. And we can imagine that if we were to do that, we'll have transformation of water resources from agriculture to higher value uses. Dr. Clay has also talked about reflecting prices, the embedded water in prices of food. Perhaps that's what you were suggesting. And as maybe one of those semi-single issue organizations, I'm in principle in favor of that because I want to do something to preserve water. But what do we do about the cost for poor people in the form of higher food prices, less food produced, higher water prices. How do we reconcile that problem, which will likely accompany the suggested reforms you're suggesting?
Thank you.
I think one of the things that we need to understand is that a lot of poor people produce food, and it's not necessarily going to be a hardship for them to have higher prices for food. Very few people, let's say, are truly self-sufficient, but generally higher prices for food could, in fact, have interesting implications for resources and assets globally, I think. And so I would want to look there. But if part of that price or much of that price is because of increased prices for carbon and increased prices for agricultural inputs because of carbon prices and increased prices for water, there's going to be precious little left for producers at the end of the day. So this is a real issue. And maybe the issue has got to be that we begin to look at how producers can scale up through asset development and equity types of investments into larger units that aggregate and add value, and where there's a little more control over some of those issues. You know, I don't have a crystal ball here any more than anybody else does. We have some pretty serious problems, and it's going to take a little thinking to figure out how to deal with them, and it's going to be very different probably in different parts of the world. But what we see now is countries, I think, even like China, that basically are importing an increasing amount of what they need, but what they're actually importing is water and soil, which they don't have. And that reality is becoming more common, and with climate change likely to become even more so.
Mark, would you like to
add? If I could just add a few comments to those. I think the other thing is that what we're seeing is that water is leaving agriculture under any circumstances, and what's happening is you're seeing it basically expropriated for industrial and urban uses without proper compensation to farmers. But I actually don't advocate, say, charging high direct prices to farmers. What I would argue is that you need to, first of all, recognize the water rights, which is not easy, as you know, but then to buy those water rights as necessary from farmers. And you do get a dynamic process going. It was also shown in this study that John cited in India that you do then can improve the efficiency of use of water in agriculture and reinvest some of the proceeds of the purchases into the agriculture sector and to get dynamic changes in productivity. Some people will lose, but broadly there I think are going to be larger gains than under the current systems that we're having.
One other thing to follow up on that is if we have a system of payments for carbon that are based on avoided carbon loss, why couldn't we begin to think about a system of water payments that are based on avoided water use that really recompenses producers for becoming more efficient? Now, this would have to work within a watershed level rather than at a global level because water is a local issue and scarcity is more of a local issue, although an increasingly common one.
Thank you. Last week in Istanbul during the World Water Forum, I think it was the chair of the European Parliament Development Subcommittee who introduced a law to be ratified by the European Parliament to make compulsory water impact assessments, such as environmental impact assessments. So what Jason was saying was pretty much along the same lines. Any other questions or contributions from the audience? Yes. Just 1 second, please. Yes.
Yes, thank you. Actually, I want to ask a question to Mark. He has estimated the area's loss due to climatic change, means grain-producing areas lost. And also, he also showed some green areas where there is a gain. For example, some losses in U.S., but there are gains of area in the Canada, etc. Has he done any kind of analysis whether there is a net effect is more loss, or is there any gain is one point. Second point is there any distributional consequences? Say there is more area in India versus reduced area in the U.S. Will have any distributional aspect? Thank you.
Yeah, I mean the results that we're showing is that you're moving out of say very prime productivity land in the U.S. and then moving into Canada, and then there's also these areas in Russia and parts of Russia that come in, which I think are not as sustainable or as high yield. It could be that the soils will develop over time, but those are not as stable soils, as not as productive soils. So the net loss of those land use changes is also negative, in addition to the loss of productivity in areas that do stay in maize. And we are finding that typically, the U.S. is quite hard hit in our results, and we're still comparing with other studies as well. But Sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia tend to get hit very hard on not just maize, but on wheat and rice as well from the climate change assessment that we're doing. So it has, in a sense, negative distributional impacts there. But also because of the U.S. going out, if it goes out in a large way, that is going to result in much higher prices in the markets, which could help some farmers but also hurt poor consumers in the developing world.
Thank you, Mark. This concludes panel one, and I'm inviting Eric to the podium to officially conclude and make announcements for the rest of the day.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for your chairmanship of this panel. Thanks to our speakers. I now have the pleasure of inviting all of you to lunch.